And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own question.
If you're a parent of a child who's been diagnosed with conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, I want you to know that there's a controversy in our field right now, and we are re-examining the idea of the DSM diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorders and behavioral disorders, essentially, for especially young children, as reflecting disruption in the nervous system and the need for relational security, as well as looking at why there's difficulty with that self-regulation. What is causing a child to have defiant behaviors and oppositional behaviors? So please understand that this may not actually be a disorder, and many therapists, me included, believe that this is not an appropriate diagnosis for a child under the age of 5, and that we should look to the nervous system, look to their development, their neurodevelopment, to discover the causes of those behaviors, rather than labeling a child with a pretty severe and stigmatizing diagnosis.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I have someone who's already been on the podcast, and it's such a great episode. She is someone who I just love learning from myself, definitely a resource that I use, with her book, Beyond Behaviors, and her newer book, Brain Body Parenting. There are so many golden nuggets that this person has to share with us. Her perspective is great. She does such a great job at really taking the science and making it understandable and relatable to everyone in a way that we can use practically and applicably in classrooms and households, and I think even in the workplace. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce to you Mona De La Hook, and feel free to talk a little bit about yourself and share anything that you want people to know about you before we dive into our conversation for today, which I'll mention in a moment.
Oh, well, first of all, it is such an honor to be talking with you again. I am so grateful for this opportunity and for all the great stuff you are helping with for us to better understand our littles, our bigs, us as parents, as teachers, as providers. So, yeah, I'm just so excited to be here. My background is that I'm a clinical psychologist. And early in my profession, I was having, I was seeing, you know, teenagers and older children and adults. And I kept on hearing such stories of trauma and difficulties in childhood that I decided I wanted to really start at the beginning. So there was a subspecialty called infant mental health, which is not putting little infants on a couch and having them tell you how they feel. It was the study of brain development and how the brain and body develops. And luckily, when I did this, it was a long time ago, in the 1990s, which was known as the decade of the brain. And it changed everything about how I viewed my field, how I viewed diagnosing people, which I'm licensed to do, and frankly, how I parented and how I took care of my own mental health. So that was the journey I've been on that led to a book called Beyond Behaviors, where I suggest a new way of looking at children's challenging behaviors, and my latest Brain Body Parenting, where we just kind of the science of resilience is so, luckily, it's so clear. Tons of science around how you raise resilient humans. And that means people who can flex through difficult situations. And all of us know what that's like. In the last 3 or 4 years, we have had to flex almost constantly through difficult situations, from the pandemic, through politics, through everything. So yeah, I'm really happy. I love my job.
Oh, I love taking in everything you do in your job. And I'm actually going to just, so today we actually have a conversation. We're going to start off with a conversation about ODD. And this is really inspired by, I knew that I had to bring you back on the podcast. When I saw this video, I'm like, oh man, like this is a conversation that needs to be had. Yeah. And this conversation is going to filter into other conversations that we're going to speak more broadly about children in general. And so this is whether you are, you know, you've been diagnosed with ODD, or you have a child that's been diagnosed with ODD, or you're in the classroom with a child that's been diagnosed with ODD. This is for you, and this episode's really going to be for everyone. So, yeah. Because it is parallels a lot of things. This is a pattern of the way that we're seeing things, the way that we're treating children. But I'm going to go ahead and play the video that inspired the beginning of this conversation. Then we're going to get into the conversation. Right. I'm just going to play the sound.
If you're a parent of a child who's been diagnosed with conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, I want you to know that there's a controversy in our field right now, and we are re-examining the idea of the DSM diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorders and behavioral disorders, essentially, for especially young children, as reflecting disruption in the nervous system and the need for relational security, as well as looking at why there's difficulty with that self-regulation. What is causing a child to have defiant behaviors and oppositional behaviors? So please understand that this may not actually be a disorder, and many therapists, me included, believe that this is not an appropriate diagnosis for a child under the age of 5, and that we should look to the nervous system, look to their development, their neurodevelopment, to discover the causes of those behaviors, rather than labeling a child with a pretty severe and stigmatizing diagnosis.
My first question, that we got us to start at the ground level, what is ODD? Like, tell us more about how someone gets diagnosed with that. What are the signs that people look for? Like, what is ODD? Break it down for us.
Yeah. Okay. So ODD is a diagnosis that is or a label that's found in something called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It is kind of like the dictionary system for diagnosing psychiatric disorders in the United States and really across the world. So it is a manual that helps us understand diagnoses such as anxiety, depression, and this diagnosis that I'm calling into question, which ODD stands for oppositional defiant disorder. So let me just first of all say that the DSM manual is a system that just looks at observable behaviors. And if you have a certain amount of behaviors that clump together, then you get this diagnosis. The DSM does not tell you what causes something. It does not suggest the treatment approach. It's just a labeling system. So people need to know that. And also, people need to know that the DSM has been called into question by a lot of scientists. So this manual is outdated. And one person who believes that is Tom Insel, who was the head of the National Institutes of Mental Health for a decade. And he has recently written a book, but he wrote a pretty strong statement that the DSM really is hasn't been very useful in research or practice. And so as a psychologist, I have had to use the DSM. People use these labels to get services for the child, for example, right? If you need to get reimbursed by insurance, you need a diagnosis. If you need help in the school system, you need a diagnosis. It's kind of a gatekeeper. So let's just say that, of course, we need some system. And this is the kind of clunky system that we have to work with. So back to your question, what is ODD? ODD is a label that is used for children who have a persistent pattern of oppositional behavior or defiant behavior. So these would be children who have a very difficult time going with the flow. They often have big explosive reactions to simple requests, and such that it really impacts their daily functioning. So it's to a point where it's not just a typical, you know, pushback, but it's really a pattern of a human who is pushing back on almost everything. And to get this diagnosis, you know, it's very stressful for a family. It's because you're managing a little human or a larger human who really is having trouble in their occupation of being a student or being a kid.
Okay. So, all right. We have a better understanding of what ODD is. Why is it being called into question by therapists and psychologists? Like, where do they think the mistake is at, and why?
Yeah. So first I'll say that I don't know how many of us are out there. So I wrote an article about it in 2016. And no worries. And so I first of all want to say that if you are a parent or a provider and or a teacher, and this diagnosis has been given, I don't intend this to be for you to not trust the provider, because this is the system we have to work with. I am an outlier in that I'm calling into question these diagnoses because I'm looking at them through the lens of neuroscience. So my you may not find a lot of people who agree with me. However, that post, you know, the video that you played and the article that I wrote about ODD has been shared, you know, well over 100,000 times. So I think there are people out there who believe that this diagnosis, it's not that it's wrong to have a child who has all these behaviors. To me, that means that this is a very vulnerable person, a vulnerable meaning their nervous system is kind of trigger happy. They get thrown off by small asks in life. And the problem with the diagnosis is not with the diagnosis, but with what we do with it. And what we do with it right now is that we think this kid has a problem. We think this kid is defiant, which means they are misbehaving, which means we have to give them behavior plans and we have to get them to go with the flow and be more compliant. That's the problem, because it's not an issue of compliance. It's an issue of the brain and body detecting threat, even when that person is objectively safe. So you may ask them to, you know, make their bed, for example, and they could just have a full blown tantrum. It's hard. It's hard. It looks like misbehavior, but it's not, it's something else. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So they're detecting threat. And the reason why they're not being compliant or the reason why they're pushing back is because their body is detecting a threat. It's having a threat response to something in the environment or something that's happening in their body. And so, you know, and you said a simple request, you know, make up your bed or, you know, close the door on your way out or put on your shoes, whatever it is. Right. Put your plate away, something that we deem them to be fully capable of doing, but they are pushing back against it. What is a parent to do? What is a teacher to do when you have a child who is pushing back for things that we deem to be very simple and they seem to be very capable of doing?
Yes. First of all, let us give all of those parents and teachers a moment of compassion, because it is not easy to manage a child or several children in a classroom who have these big responses. So compassion, first of all, it's not your bad parenting. It's not that you're not a good teacher. This is a deeply internal response. It's what's happening inside the child in response to what's going on outside. But what matters most is not what's going on outside. It's what's happening inside the child. Mm. For some reason, and it's a mystery because each child has their own reason, there's a stress response happening inside. So when that request is made, something happens very fast. The hypothalamus sends information to the pituitary gland, which squirts out these stress hormones. And all of a sudden you have something called this HPA axis. The person, the little human, within seconds is feeling like they have to fight or run away. And there's a little glitch in the safety detection system. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with the child, but that glitch is saying, you can't do this right now. You can't make your bed right now. The glitch is saying, this somehow is so uncomfortable that I'm going to say no. And it's not conscious, it's subconscious. This is an important point, is that this is not a choice that that child is making. It happens too fast. The circuitry in the brain is the automatic circuitry, not the thoughtful one. So I know that's a lot to take in, but what's happening is an automatic threat detection response. There are some theories about why this happens, and I can go into that if you want. Like, it's one of the latest theories, which I talk about a lot right now, is that the brain is a prediction machine. Dr. Feldman Barrett's lab is looking at the brain is constantly predicting what's going to happen next within milliseconds. It's a prediction machine. And for some individuals, when the ask goes against what their brain is predicting is going to have happen. So let's just say someone says, make the bed, but that child is thinking, I'm going to have a few more minutes to watch my video, for example. They're predicting video. The parent says bed, and all of a sudden their body is off to the races. It's an incompatible ask. Their body says no, even though their mind might want to say yes.
Yes.
It's a stress response. And our culture doesn't have language for a stress response yet. All we have language for is misbehaving, behaving, good behavior, bad behavior, good kid, bad kid. And unfortunately, this ODD diagnosis carries with it a terrible stigma for children in the education system, in our social justice system, in our foster children. This diagnosis is given to children with deviant behaviors who also, unfortunately, many of them have had trauma histories. And we know that people with trauma histories and people with sensitive nervous systems can have these big stress behaviors.
Okay, so it's not a choice because it's happening so automatically. It's happening within milliseconds because the brain is predicting that things are going to go one way, but then it doesn't go that way. It, you know, the world doesn't go the way that they expect it to, or they want it to, or that they're predicting for
that their brain is predicting. Right, right. That it and that mismatch for some people is so uncomfortable that they oppose.
Yeah.
You know, for some people who don't have something called self-regulation, their self-regulation hasn't been built yet. And, you know, most little ones are working on self-regulation. As you know, the kids you work with, you know, the young ones, 2 to 6 years old, sometimes they can do something that they don't want to do or they are not expecting. Sometimes, you know, it's time to put away the Play-Doh. And sometimes they, you know, a little, even a three-year-old might be able to say, I don't want to, but okay. Right. You know, they do that. But that's a process. And it's built over years, not months. And here's another developmental principle. Just because a child can do something some of the time doesn't mean their brain and body can do it all of the time, because that threat detection system floats. It goes up and down. So they're not able to reliably do it all the time. And sometimes caregivers and parents, and I know I felt this way before I learned it, in my head, I was like, wait a second, you did this yesterday. I know you can do this. You're just putting me on a show for me here. And so we tend to think like, hey, I know they can do this. I'm going to push them pretty hard. And each child is different as far as their nervous system response. And of course, we want to push children to stretch. Of course we do. But for certain kids, a small ask can feel devastating.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear it all the time. It's the, you know, you should know better. And, you know,
I know you can do this. I've seen you do this before. You should know better. Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, even as an adult, there are sometimes I can do certain things on some days where another day I can't do it. And I think especially parents and teachers, you know, can really empathize with this. There are some days where, especially if you're on this journey, right, you're learning new skills, you're trying to learn how to self-regulate, because it's likely that, you know, it wasn't a skill that you were being taught growing up. Now your capacity for self-regulation may have grown as you've grown, gotten older, and you've developed more, but the intentional skill of self-regulation, most of us weren't taught. So a lot of times we're learning it with children because they're triggering us. They're triggering something in us internally. And some days we may be really good at self-regulating and redirecting, offering choices, offering empathy, connection, all the things, and really seeing the best in them. But another day, maybe you didn't have the sleep that you normally get or that you were hoping to get or that you're used to. Maybe something happened with the family member and you're stressed out about that. Maybe it's just you woke up on the wrong side of the bed, kind of deal. Yes. And even in, you know, I think it's something we can very much empathize with. This is a huge point of, can be a huge point of empathy for us, because, you know, just think about the days where you are able to, and I'm going to give one more example for my teachers out there. Yeah. There's a lot of inconsistency that happen, especially in early childhood, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe some days where everything is, you have your consistent co-teacher and you're all on the same page and you got the system, everyone's flowing, everything's going well. It's maybe a Wednesday, it's a Thursday, it's in the morning. So you still have your, you know, you still have the energy, your coffee is still kicking in.
You got your spoons going. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Everything's flowing. You may be able to handle that child throwing a tantrum or saying no or being defiant or, you know, but when you don't have your co-teacher or your partner, you know, maybe your husband or your wife, they're out of town or something, and things aren't the way in the routine, the way that your brain is predicting them to be, we're not at our best either. Now, and we may yell more, and we may have more behaviors that we ourselves have committed to not doing. but we still do it because even though we may not be, you know, we may not be at our best, we're still doing our best, even with, we're still doing our best with the situation and the state that we're in and the resources that we have in that moment. And so it's the same thing for children too. But children tend to fluctuate even more. Like, you know, think about a child who, where everything is, they're learning so many new things and there's so many misses because everything's still so new to them. And they're still learning so many skills. So while they may have shown a skill to self-regulate and cooperate one day, or to put their shoes on a nut one day, it doesn't mean that in every moment, in every moment, in every state, that they're always going to be able to do that. And so, you know, my question, I want to kind of come back to this because I want to go to like the practicality, and I have some ideas too. So maybe we can kind of bounce some ideas off.
Right.
When you are, when there is a child who is in that state, maybe their brain is predicting the world's not going, you know, their way. Their brain is predicting it's going to be one way, but it's not that way. They woke up on the wrong side, whatever it is. How do we still help them so that we can all be successful in that moment as the parent, as the teacher, as the child? How do we move forward and elicit their, you know, cooperation in these moments where they're in a kind of a state of defiance?
So I usually don't have quick fix phrases. But I do have something that's pretty extraordinarily working really well. And so I'll share it with you. If we understand something to be a prediction error, so let's just say a toddler has, in, you know, you're asking a toddler to set the little snack table, right? They're your helper. And they were 100% positive that the snack of the day was going to be some yummy granola bars. But what, as it turns out, it's carrots. Okay. And they are just, they see that and they just burst into tears like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to set it. Okay, that's a classic prediction error. You're asking them, you're thinking, okay, you're having such a big reaction over something so small. But here's the two things we do. Number one, tell ourselves, prediction error. They were expecting one thing. Their brain was expecting one thing. Something else happened. And number two, when you have, like you said, that calm body with empathy, nothing is more important than an adult seeing someone's pain. In our old paradigm, we'd be like, and I myself included, please, this is how I treated my own kids. Like, give me a break. Okay, you might have cookies later today, but for now it's carrots. Get over it. But if we do this instead, tell ourselves, oh, they're thrown off, completely thrown off. This unexpected thing just happened. And so with a kind face and body and staying calm ourselves, we're like, oh my goodness, that was a surprise. That was unexpected. I think you thought maybe we were going to get those granola bars today. Oh, that was such a surprise. Or whatever word that child can understand about unexpected or surprise, use your own word. But I tell you, I've been using this for several years now with toddlers that I work with. And when you call it, like when you legitimately don't fight them on it and say, this is so unexpected. And the message you're giving them is, I'm witnessing your pain, buddy, and I'm not judging it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I loved what you said about how we are all working on our own self-regulation. But Mr. Chaz, I know when I was growing up, my self-regulation was taught out of me. My dear parents, my dear mom, tried to talk me out of my distress. Like, no, you shouldn't be upset. You should be happy. And here's why. She had good intentions. But I'm learning about my own nervous system. This has been a journey for me, and it always will be, because many of us still are working on our own self-regulation, getting to know our nervous systems. This is why, one reason why we have such huge rates of heart disease in our world. It's clearly related to stress. The research on that is so clear. High blood pressure, heart disease at early ages, chronic activation of our own stress response, which is kind of a side note, because I'm very concerned about our physical health and stress. But if we can say, and to this, it's good for our health as parents and caregivers, it's good for the child's health to say, I believe you, that was a surprise. And yes, we're going to have carrots today, but I wonder if we might be having those granola bars tomorrow. Maybe we'll ask the snack monitor. And then we work with the child. You see their body kind of relax, and we're going with them rather than against them.
Yes, going with them rather than against them. I 100% agree too. And, you know, I do this all the time too with the kids that, you know, I work with. And there's such a big difference when, and I also see the other thing too, because, you know, I have worked with people, do work with people that will try to, you know, they do things the way that they were raised. And it's, you know, to really try to talk the child out of, pretty much convince them to not feel that emotion, that, you know, whatever they're experiencing isn't a big deal, and to try to just logically talk them out of it. And a lot of times they get even more amped up and really trying to convince that this is real. And if we just believe them in the beginning and just allow for them to experience their moment and help them process that moment, right? Help them process that prediction error. Yes. And one of the phrases that we use in conscious discipline is you were hoping, right? You Love were it. Hoping to yeah. have carrots today. You were hoping to have such and such. Another thing that we use, and I'm not, again, I always say, like, here's a script, don't use it. So, because, you know, I don't want people to get caught in, and I've had a whole episode, you know, talking about scripts, so I'm not going to go deep into it. But what's important, as like we're sharing, you know, certain phrases, is that you really metabolize and understand more of the approach of what we're saying and the why behind it. That's and right. let it come from you.
That's
you
know, 100%. Yeah.
Another phrase that I, you know, really like kind of use, and kind of this, a way to kind of show empathy, that like to really see them in this moment is like you want it. You were wanting this to happen. So you were wanting, you were hoping, this is a surprise, really processing that, like, you know, things didn't go our way, and not trying to, you know, talk them out of feeling it, but just being with them in that feeling, as opposed to trying to just make the feeling go away.
100%.
And there is, like, I'm about to get on my soapbox right now, because there's something else that happens when we do this, is that that creates, when we are with a child in their distress, in their struggles, and not even just with children, just with humans, when we are able to really offer empathy and be with them in that, that creates more of a connection between us. When you're going through, and think about, like, you know, even as an adult, like something that you've been through, like who was there for you, and whoever was there for you, I'm sure your bond grew that day or that moment or that time period, because they were with you in that and didn't try to convince you, not that you were feeling it, that they were with you in that. Yes. And there's, you know, another phrase in conscious discipline that, you know, that, you know, aligns part of the brain science, that connection primes the brain for willingness, right? And so, you know, being with them in their struggle, really seeing them in that struggle creates a stronger bond and connection between me and you, and more of a feeling of just like, we're all on the same team. Like it's not going to be a me versus you. Like, I'm feeling this way. No, you shouldn't feel this way. Cause that's what it becomes. It becomes a me versus you. And so the reaction, the normal reaction, is to fight back against that, to push back. And so while these, you know, children may be more inclined to push back, a lot of times we exacerbate that. We perpetuate that even more by seeing them as defiant, by seeing this as a battle that we have to win, and that we just have to push them harder because I know you can do it, as opposed to just seeing them and being with them in their struggle and creating that connection. And that will create more willingness on their part to be, to feel more safe, to feel to be more willing to do that thing, even when they don't particularly want to put their plate away that day. And so it all goes full circle. And I'll say something else too, especially, you know, seeing this as a prediction error, right? Yeah. Helping them to predict more accurately what is going to happen next. A lot of times us as adults don't do a great job at helping them, you know what's coming next and communicating that.
We realize it's too late. Like, oh shoot, we're 5 minutes late. And then we're like, okay, it's time. And we're asking them to do something without letting them know.
Yeah.
Without giving them a little warning to their nervous system that it's going to be time to transition soon.
Yes. Yes. And one thing that can be helpful, another thing that can be helpful for people out there who are trying to figure out what to do, how to be, you know, maybe more proactive, so that you have more of these, less of these moments where you're having to kind of, because it can be exhausting, right? Doing this all day, right? To trying to connect and offer empathy through the nose and the defiance. So there's also, you know, using, I'm a big fan of using visuals to help communicate, especially with young children too, because a lot of times, sometimes we'll even, even if we're good at like, all right, I give you like a 5 minute warning, or hey, such and such is going to happen today. I know it doesn't normally happen this way, or hey, like in a little bit, something's going to happen. Something's going to change. Something's going to happen. There's going to be a transition, whatever it is. We say it to children auditorily. A lot of times, like, their ability to really hold that idea and to keep that in their mind and to it is, is limited. They're still developing it. And so visuals can be a huge help when communicating, especially with young children.
Yes.
So that...
That is so true. That visual is a support. And what you're describing about this long-term process is that humans learn how to be by something called statistical learning. You have to go thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of times around the block to understand certain types of patterns and to have those patterns make sense to your nervous system. And think about, in their statistical learning, little ones of even up to age 10, but especially under 5, they're early in the game. They don't have the patterns we have. So we're expecting they are going to react to a transition the same way we do, and that they're going to be cooperative, and that they're going to be good little children, and all these things that are not developmentally appropriate. What's developmentally appropriate is dysregulation when they have to do something really quick. That's because their self-regulation, the beautiful thing you just described, when we witness someone suffering instead of judging it, when we believe that it's genuinely painful right now, that I have to put away my Play-Doh. And when we believe that, when we honor their nervous system response, because crying and screaming and whining are not intentional behaviors meant to make our life difficult. Those are stress responses. When we honor, I see that as stressful in you. We are building self-regulation through this learning process that is going to help that eventual teenager and adult be able to honor their own self, their own nervous system, to say, oh, this is rough right now. I'm a little agitated, but I'm going to take a few steps outside and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do something to help myself with my issues. And that is such a big gift. I have to tell you that as an adult, I'm working on my self-regulation. I will the rest of my life because I did not have it built in me. I did not have an adult. Actually, I did. I have had one person who, my grandmother, who was there during the summers. And I had that grandmother who actually co-regulated and saw my suffering and my pain and witnessed it without trying to solve it. And just letting me know that she was there no matter what. It was such a gift, Mr. Chaz. And just only every other, you know, every summer for a month or two. But during my distressed times in my life, when I went through a crisis, her face, I can see her. She's been gone for 20 years. I can see her. And I carry her in me as that person who witnessed me and who believed in me. And I want kids, little kids, to have that. And if you never have had it, so much compassion for yourself, that's okay. We can build it in ourselves through self-compassion. And what we're talking about is a deeply relational process. And that was hijacked many, many decades ago by this very interesting theory of behaviorism, which was a very interesting line of study. It still is. We know that you can manipulate animals' behaviors through reinforcement schedules. It's very interesting stuff. But we are now almost in 2023, and we know how resilience is built. It's built through exactly what you described. Those kiddos that you see, that you work with, and those teachers that you mentor, to say, look, this is a moment where we can connect with a child and believe that they are having a hard time with this, and that they don't need to be taught that their behavior is wrong. I remember for my own kids, when they had these big reactions, this was my first thought. This was before I knew the developmental step. My first thought was, you're not going to survive in the world if you have this attitude. And I need to teach you how to have a better attitude because I want you to be successful in life. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what but what that meant was, sadly, and I talk about this in the book, so it's not a surprise that I overrode their stress responses as misbehaviors. And I didn't see them as vulnerable behaviors. I saw them as them choosing to be like extra and choosing to be like not go with the flow or spoiled. And it's like, not my kid. You're not going to be spoiled. So I come with this very humbly, because that's how I was raised. But there's a new way, what you just described. And this is how we build resilience.
There's something else. I wasn't planning on touching on this, but you mentioned it a little bit earlier in our talk. And I want to just hear more about what you have to say about this, of just how you were, self-regulation was taught out of you. Yeah. And how we have a tendency to kind of dismiss the emotions of children, their stress responses. So their stress kind of gets stuck in their body, and it impacts their health. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the impact of because I think a lot of times people don't recognize the physical impact that kind of dismissing emotions and these stress responses can have on our own body and the body of growing, developing children. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'm so glad you picked up on that. Let's pick up that thread. It's huge. There are a lot of of stress researchers, trauma researchers, but most recently internist named Gabor Maté writes a lot about the human illness, right? Human illness, like heart disease and stress-related diseases, et cetera, and trauma. And he talks about the disconnection from the self. And what does that mean? It means that when you are when you're a child and you are going through a difficult time, if you don't get that support from caring adults around you, you make these automatic disconnects in order to survive. So you kind of disconnect what's going on from your body. What might that look like? If an adult would say over and over again, like, "Oh, you're overreacting. You shouldn't be upset about that. Come on, nothing's wrong." And perfectly wonderful parents will say that. Okay. My mom, I adore her. She tried so hard. But when I was a deeply anxious child and I had deep fears, and it stressed my mother out so bad to see me in pain that she would just say anything she could to stop it. "Oh, you don't feel that way. Oh no, don't worry. It's not so bad. You'll see that friend again in 6 months, you know, or your dad's late from work and I think he's okay, but maybe someone knocked him over the head." I mean, literally those are the things my wonderful mom would say. And I would disconnect. I'd be like, "Okay, now I'm going to go clean my room, or now I'm going to go make sure I can control whatever in my life I can control," because I didn't have that fear witnessed and validated. So physical health has to do with a lack of disconnection from the self. So if you want to have physical health, we want our children and ourselves to be able to sense what's happening in our body. So if you can feel your heartbeat, if you can know when you are stressed to the point where your blood pressure is probably going up, and so many of us have high blood pressure, even at young ages, we can start to close that gap between the physical sensations in the body and our brains, our minds telling us you need to disconnect, because that's what we did in childhood to survive. So many of us had to get through childhood on our body's fight or flight response or disconnect response that was protective. It helped us get through. And there's nothing wrong with that. But as we age, that disconnect can harm our health. Mm-hmm. So we, like, if you suppress anger, a lot, it's going to go into your heart system, right? It's going to live in your cells. It's going to be in there. And if you do if you're a constant pleaser, for example, if you're always working to please other people, and if they are upset at you, you go into this just kind of panic mode. That's probably a very early childhood experience that in which you had to do that in order to feel safe. So the health, mental health and physical health, is inextricably connected. It's very connected. And what you and I are talking about right now is giving our children, especially if we can start young in preschool, giving our children the message that they don't have to disconnect from their true self in order to be loved by us. And in ODD, let's bring it back to ODD. It is absolutely an inappropriate diagnosis, in my opinion, for anyone under the age of 5. I think it should be wiped out of the DSM, and it will be in the next rendition, I believe. But let's honor that stress response and prevent the disconnect from self. You are helping parents and teachers not to do that, Mr. Chaz. You, in conscious discipline, in responsive parenting, in brain body parenting, we are helping lay out the roadmap to reduce trauma, to reduce these heart-related and physiological-related conditions later in life, because we're helping them not disconnect from their true selves. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's powerful. So traditionally, we have, children have had to typically have to survive. They have to disconnect from what they're feeling, their emotions. And us adults do a very good job at encouraging children, almost forcing children to ignore what's going on internally, to please the adults, to be accepted in the community. And children very much need our community, their caregivers to survive. So oftentimes they do that. And with this disconnection comes very real, health problems that happen internally in the body, with the immune system, with your heart, with your gut.
And those may not show up until you're 50 or 60, or 40, but it's not like you're going to see them right away. But absolutely, over time, the inflammation caused by that disconnect between what's going on in your body, it does create inflammation in the body over time.
So you're not even just impacting your emotional, your mental health is tied to your physical health. And so if we want to get to the root, I think the root of, what's causing the behaviors in children who are being diagnosed with ODD, and get to the root of a lot of our physical health problems, is if we get a lot better at accepting the emotions and really accepting the children, but accepting the emotions that come with it, instead of trying to get them to shove it down or not acknowledge it, but really be with them in their emotions and allow them to feel those emotions, to process those emotions, to express those emotions in a safe environment. And if we can do that, if we can create a community, if we can create the habit of doing it ourselves and create communities that can do that, that can accept people who are struggling or having a hard time, I think a lot of these behaviors, we won't see as much. And a lot of these physical problems that come up, we won't see as much. And so that's really at the root of it. Now, the challenge of it is, the hard thing is that we've already, most of us people who are grown, have the conditioning already in our body of the way that we were raised, with the fear and shame-based parenting that kind of, forced us to keep our emotions inside or not show them. And so that's our reaction. That's our automatic reaction too, a lot of the time. So how, and I think this is kind of probably the last question I have, we have time for. I could talk to you all day, Mona.
I know, likewise. Yeah.
So how do we have this conditioning in our body of seeing children in this way, and seeing these behaviors and seeing the emotions in this way, and we are reacting.
Yes.
How do we then teach children?
Yes.
Not to react in the same way. How do we respond to them differently? We're having reactions. Like, how do we teach this skill that we are still, that we don't have, that we're still developing?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. Because like you said, many of us either don't have the skill, weren't raised with it, so it's not in our subconscious memory. We have these automatic responses too. So number one, developing awareness. Awareness is going to allow us to know when we're doing something automatically or when we're doing something intentionally, consciously. Okay, so awareness is great. However, In my mind, we can't do awareness without a ton of self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And the science, I talk about self-compassion a lot, and the research that I studied for brain body parenting shows hard research that self-compassion actually reduces inflammation in the physical body. Mm. Because if we don't have self-compassion, parents are already beating ourselves up. 90% of parents feel judged most of the time, either by others or by themselves. So mm-hmm. awareness plus this deep compassion, and that sounds fluffy, but it is so hard science, because compassion actually, and what that means is treating yourself at the way you would treat a dear friend, mm-hmm. what you would be saying to a dear friend if they messed up, is, you know, like, you're not a bad person. This happened. May I be gentle on myself? Because if we can do that, we can be gentle on our kids. So it really starts with us, with awareness, with compassion to the self. And then in our head, like when I see, I was at Whole Foods late last night, and I saw this mama, this dear mama, and a two-year-old. The mother's face was red. The child was screaming, wanting something. And the mother was growing increasingly agitated with the child. And I could tell she thought that this child was misbehaving. And all I wanted to do was wrap both of them up and say, mama, you know, it's time to go home. Look towards that. Look to yourself and say, this is too much right now. Look to the child and say, oh, my dear boy, it's time to go home. When we shift the lens to looking at our body budget, our physiology, our humanness, our limitations, and remember that we're probably asking too much of ourselves and our kids. We are a very disconnected culture. We need more help, and we're trying to do things on our own too much. We're not little small communities of families, which is how humans were raised for, you know, thousands of years. Yeah. Short answer, long answer to a very profound question. We're on this journey together, mm-hmm. and self-compassion is going to help us, because this is a new way of thinking, and building self-regulation is not yet a part of our parenting and our education paradigm. We're mostly compliance-based in our education system. And little by little, I think it's getting infiltrated that we have to shift that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, part of what you said is the way that we see, the way that we're seeing the behavior, the perception helps us keep composure.
Yes.
And, you know, your book, Brain Body Parenting, did a really great job at, I think, helping parents see children and their behaviors in a different way, in a way where you can kind of see, just even just with the some of the behaviors that children will show, you can see when they're struggling more, when they're in a state of disconnection, in a survival state, when they're in this emotional state, right? That's really huge for me too, as someone who is a practitioner of all this stuff, to really be able to see the child where they're at, and not just with words, but with the body language, to see where they're at, where there's a deficit in their body budget, and so I can be more proactive in the things that I do, in kind of adding to their account. And it also helps too. One thing I will say to just kind of add is that to just continue learning different ways to connect and to guide children and to see behavior. That is an ongoing journey too, because, you know, the awareness is really important. The self-compassion is also really important. Those are integral. Those are like very foundational, but you also don't have, you know, we've all kind of grown up in an environment of shame, fear-based tactics. And so what comes up for us is like, it's still like, okay, well, what do I do? How do I actually connect with this child?
Yeah. Like, what do I do instead? Right. It's like realizing this is not a discipline issue is one thing. And it's huge. Like if you can shift that lens, that can calm your body down. Like, okay, this isn't a discipline issue right now, but what do we do instead? That is where you're guiding us in real time, because then we need to have a replacement.
Yeah.
Away from the sticker charts, away from the, put your square down, or you move your behavior chart down. All of those things are going to make kids more stressed. So
I'm going to end with a story, something that happened. And I only shared this story on my Instagram subscriber only post because it's something that happened with a child not too long ago, and I try to share as much as I can while still keeping confidentiality, and so I typically don't share stories that are too where people can tell who I'm talking about. But if you made it all the way to the end of this podcast, you deserve to hear this. And I'll try to say it in a way where it's not super obvious, but there was a child who was coming off of the bus, and you know, one of my duties or my duty at that point in time was to receive the children off the bus and then kind of transition them in. So a child came off the bus, and this is a child who spilt a little bit of you know, he has a little bit of a reputation of sometimes having a hard time. Child gets emotional, and sometimes when they're in an emotional or kind of like a state of like survival, when that threat detection is happening, they have a hard time of following directions. That becomes their thing. And a lot of times, sometimes the behavior gets labeled. And so a child came off the bus, and his shoulders were visibly slumped. And he was just like, he was looking down. It was clear that he was upset about something. And so I was, you know, he's coming off the bus. And so I was trying to be really intentional. First thing I did is said, I'm happy to see you. Insert name here. Like we miss you, like welcome back. And just with my intention there for saying that was, you are safe. You're in a community of people who love you, who miss you. You are safe here. That didn't change his state. He was still slumped over, but I'm still communicating. And it wasn't just the words I said, it was my tone, it was my body language. And then, so he came over and he was kind of waiting. We were standing because we were waiting for other kids to get off the bus. And I saw him and said, you seem really upset. Something must have happened, right? Not in, why are you so mad? Like, you know, face-to-face smile or anything like that. It's seeing him like something must have happened because he wasn't very responsive. And I'm seeing the behavior as opposed to judging the behavior. Something must have happened. You know, your shoulders are, you know, you're slumped over like this. Something must have happened. Mm-hmm. And he said in a very kind of low voice, oh my boy. And I kind of understood him a little bit. It's like something happened to your toy. And another child chimed in and said, because I guess he kind of been in the state for a little while. He said, I lost my toy. Or no, the other child said, I'm sorry. The other child said, he lost his toy. And so I was like, oh, you lost your toy. Which toy was it? And it was little like airplane toy. And I'm like, man, I know you really love that toy. Like you carry that toy with you everywhere. That must be so disappointing not to have your toy with you. And so I was spent some time just like, yeah, that must be really tough for you. Really seeing him, kind of naming the emotions, being with him in that moment. Mm. So we kind of got in and I asked him, I said, hey, because this is a moment where I still like, hey, let's process this. Let's, you know, let's feel to heal, right? And so I asked him, like, do you want to kind of draw your toy and kind of draw what you're feeling? And so he took the paper and the pencil and he drew his toy and he brought it to me. And so we talked about it a little bit more. And Again, still processing. My goal right here is just process what he's feeling, not to get rid of it, not to say it's not a big deal. You have so many other toys, you know. All right, but we got to move. It's not important. But really, just taking the time to process that with him, and then. After we kind of spent some time processing, then I want to do something else intentional. Like, okay, let's kind of, you know, we'll in conscious discipline, we kind of talk about like kind of moving them up in their brain states. And I can kind of tell he was talking. So we kind of defined like he's in an emotional state. He's still really upset. But, you know, my goal was to, because we had other things to do, was to move him up into what we call an executive state, where this is when the child is kind of more regulated. They're more able to learn and take in a new information. And so something we do in conscious discipline is something called I Love You rituals. And these are rituals that have the components of eye contact, physical touch, a playful situation, and presence. And so, you know, there's like these little songs that like we sing, and you know, I've kind of been teaching them these kind of different songs. And so I gave them, you know, a choice, like, do you want to do the Twinkle Twinkle Little Star one, or do you want to do the, Peter Peter Pumpkin Eater? And so he chose Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And in it, it was like, we sing the song Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. But in it, there's like hand claps. There's like a little bit of playfulness with our fingers. And we ended it with a hug. And so I did this I Love You ritual with him after we'd kind of processed those feelings. And what he started to do after we did that, I kind of let it breathe for a little bit because I wasn't trying to push too much. Because when you try to push, they will push back. Or just kind of letting him breathe, letting him just kind of be in the state. And I was really kind of observing. What he started to do is he started to go to my watch. And then he started to push the buttons in my watch, and then he started to ask questions about my watch. And one of the things is that the executive state, when a child is in an executive state, you know, the brain is asking, you know, like, what can I learn? And this was clear that his ability to start playing with my watch and start asking questions about my watch was clear that he kind of worked through that emotion. And it wasn't me telling him that it wasn't a big deal. We felt it. It was a very real emotion. I saw him in that moment, but we were able to work through that emotion very intentionally. And then, you know, all the other expectations, you know, that, you know, because there were other things that we had to do, he was able to meet those expectations way more easily, and even support other children who were having a hard time with emotions. And, you know, at that point, he was able to be a support for other children, and he was more willing to do all the things that we expected him to do. But if I would have just in the beginning, he would have came off the bus and like, okay, yeah, well, you need to just kind of get over it because I need you to, you know, I need you to walk here. I need you to stand here. I need you to do this. I need you to put your bag away. If I just would have focused on the expectations, it would have been very likely that he would have pushed back and would have been defiant. But through being very intentional, really seeing where his body budget was from the time of being intentional about my interaction with him, he was able to meet all these expectations that we had. So I just want to kind of share that story. And I know that we've actually gone over in our time, but you know, you can share.
That's such a great story. It's just so illustrates that the process of what we call co-regulation,
yes,
where you witness someone suffering and you don't judge it and you give it air to breathe. And you can do that with adults. You can do it with children. You can do it with yourself. This co-regulation is so beautiful. I love that story. That is such a great, that's the bow around this whole talk. I think it just shows he arrived in himself. He was, and at the very end, he's able to interact a little bit around, you know, that's like, I'm back. Yeah. And you helped me get back. You didn't force me to get back on my own.
Yeah.
And it would have been, and you know, I I hear school teachers saying, but I have so many kids. How can I do this? I hear you. But let's not use those physical constraints about our education system make us feel like we cannot do what you just described. We must do that for our vulnerable children, and they will be physically and mentally healthier for the rest of their lives. It is the way back to public health. And let's hope this podcast goes far and wide.
Yes. And I will say, very last note on the teachers out there, and then we're wrapping it up. I promise that the children who are struggling, like the time that we take to support that child, everyone else is watching, and you're creating a culture of supporting each other. So where they are more able to do it for each other, then you're able to elicit the support of the community to support this child. And that is, I don't care what academics you're teaching. There is nothing more important or impactful than to teach how we care for each other when we're struggling. So tell us about your brain. She's got Brain Body Parenting. It's a great book. I highly recommend it I honestly recommend it for teachers too. But I especially recommend it for parents. A lot of teachers are parents too. So there are a lot of lessons in there. Any last words you want to say before we turn the recording off?
I say we did it. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I feel so much more hopeful right now than I did an hour and a half ago or so. And in our current climate, in our country, and in our world, this conversation gives me hope and joy. So thank you.
What's my name? What's my name?